Hello and welcome to the Cyber Sisters podcast. We're your Cyber Sisters, Allison and Emily, two cyber educators talking ed tech pedagogy, and this week, Actively Learn with Holly Woodard. Holly Woodard is a high school English teacher and technology coach from Council Rock School District in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. She is the PAECT Advocacy Chair, 2017 Keystone Technology Star, 2018 and 2019 Keystone Technology Star Lead Learner. She is the Legislative Chair of Decoding Dyslexia PA and a member of PTAC. As a mother of a special needs child, Holly is passionate about dyslexia advocacy and credits much of her own teaching innovation to her desire to meet the needs of her most vulnerable students. Holly, welcome to the show. We're so excited to have you.
Thanks, ladies. I'm very excited to be here. This is quite an honor to be featured on your podcast. So I'm really excited to share.
Well, we couldn't be more thrilled. And now I do know a little bit of a secret about you, Holly. I know that you also teach an online version of your ELA class as well. So you actually have some experience with hybrid, which is, you know, especially rare in this world.
Yeah, it's actually interesting. I have a unique schedule where I have two classes of virtual English 12, and then I have two English 11 classes in the brick and mortar brick and mortar three-dimensional setting. And then I have a class called Critical Viewing that I teach. So about 6 years ago, we started a virtual program at Council Rock where we took some of our regular brick and mortar classes and we turned it into a virtual setting to give our kids an opportunity to experiment a little bit with choice and be able to determine the when and where and how of their learning. And it's become an incredibly successful program. And I'm actually really proud of it. It's kind of one of my accomplishments here at Council Rock. So thank you so much for drawing attention to that.
It's so useful to be able to find, especially for our model. There aren't many other educators who are doing this kind of work. And so whenever we find someone who also has experience either with cyber or with hybrid, it's really a very fruitful discussion. So you are kind of bridging the aisle, right, on both of these two things.
My virtual class, like I don't see the kids at all. They just, they don't even come in. If they get it first or ninth period, they don't come in or they go home. So I don't see them. They don't see me. We really try to model what a student would be experiencing in a completely virtual setting. So it's a really cool experience for them and for me. And yeah, it is. It's definitely modeling, you know, bridging two worlds there. And it's always like, well, in my virtual class, I have to do this. And in my English class, I do that. And we'll probably do a lot of crossover with that today in our Actively Learn discussion, because the tool that we're going to be using really serves a purpose in both worlds. So that is a really good tie into what we're talking about today.
Yeah. And I know, like, for us, especially using Actively Learn, like, there are times that I'm not sure exactly the best way to use it in my online class. But that leads right into kind of our first question. And I think I'm actually going to kind of throw two at you at the same time.
Okay.
So what is Actively Learn and how do you use it, either obviously coming at it from the online perspective, but how do you also use it in your brick and mortar? So both ways.
Yeah, two very, very loaded questions. So in reference to addressing what is it, to me, it is a, you know, comprehensive literacy-based LMS would be the best way that I could kind of describe it. Essentially, it allows me to provide reading and literacy assessments in both fiction and nonfiction. It also allows me to work with kids on their written composition. And it's just a multifaceted tool. And essentially what it looks like is the student logs in. Have the kids create an account. There's a free version, there's a personal plan, and then there's the Prime version, although the personal plan is really difficult to get anymore. So a lot of times now they're just offering it in the Prime version, which is through the district. But essentially, the students log in and they are given an assignment. And they complete the assignment, and it's, you know, literature-based, so it could be either fiction or nonfiction. And they read this story. And they have a lot of different options as they're reading. They can have words defined for them. They can have text-to-speech where the the words are then read to them. It can be read to them in multiple languages. In addition to that, they can pause and highlight something and ask me a question in real time. In addition to that, they can pause and make their own notes, highlight something, and they can annotate in it. So it's a really multifaceted digital tool. Essentially, the research shows that when it comes to literacy and reading, students are still taking away more when they read from a three-dimensional book that they're holding versus a digital text. However, what the research has shown is that if they are being asked questions actively in the process, that they actually retain more. So being asked questions while they're reading and interacting with the material, they actually end up learning more than they would from just a digital text or just a three-dimensional text. So when the student is in the text, they have some options that they can do, which I addressed, but then the teacher also has options that they can do. So they can embed questions throughout the reading. So if it's the first chapter of The Great Gatsby, I can embed multiple questions into the reading to check for understanding. So while a child's reading the text, I can see whether or not they're getting it because they then have to put in the answer. And the thing that I like about it is that they can't just breeze through it. So they have to read the material and then answer the question before it unlocks the next part of the passage. So they can't just like read it and then go back in and quickly fill in their answers. In addition to that, I can also leave them little Easter egg nuggets where like I can highlight something and I can show them my thought process or, hey, you might want to pay attention to this. This is going to come up later. Or when I was reading this, I thought this. And that is also a really useful tool because I can kind of communicate with them. Also, while they're reading it, I can message them. I can send them messages and interact with their answer. So when they write answers to a passage, say they're not getting the first part of the story, I then can in real time assess it and send them feedback. So they would, for example, they're reading a passage and we do a really cool story called The Mask of the Red Death. And in The Mask of the Red Death, if you don't really understand what's happening in the first three paragraphs, the rest of the story is kind of lost on you. So in that first...
I would be the kid who wouldn't understand the first three paragraphs.
Right. And the whole cool thing about short stories in literature is like going on this journey, and it's not that it's a terrible story and that it's so, so hard. It's just you have to have really strong reading skills and to be able to get that in the beginning. And if you got that, then like the story comes to life and it really becomes this beautiful experience, and you get to have this aha moment that feels so incredibly satisfying, and it inspires the kid then to want to learn more. What happens in a traditional classroom, when I'm in my brick and mortar classroom, if I'm not using Actively Learn, what ends up happening is I end up having them read it, they do a worksheet, I check for understanding, and then once it's all said and done, I then tell them essentially they were right or they were wrong. And the kids who were right had this great experience, and the kids who were wrong had this want experience. Actively Learn changes that, because what it does is it allows me to keep them guided on the right path in real time. So the kid reads the section, answers the question, I have up on my monitor their answer, and I can be like, you got this, you're awesome, go on. They go on to the next part. Or I can be like, you know what, you're off a little bit, reread that first paragraph. Or why would it be described as this? Why do you think they chose the color black? And I can have them go back and assess it on their own until they get it. And I never give it to them. I never give the information to them. I continue to have them go back, develop that grit, develop that resiliency, and that understanding that sometimes we don't get it in the first read. And to also understand what that feels like to be confused so that they can check it in their own writing, their own reading. So then by the time you get to the middle of the story, because in real time, it's almost like I'm in their head checking with them. Now they're on the right path. And now they can experience the story the way the author had intended it and the way that everybody else who gets it in the class is experiencing it and the way that I experienced it, which made me fall in love with the story in the first place. So then when they get to the end, the climax, it's like, oh, this was so awesome. I totally get it now. This was amazing. And they get to have that satisfaction, that payoff. And that's really, you know, why people like to read read fiction, is to get that satisfaction and the payoff of the story. So the tool is allowing my students to engage in the story in a way that I could never have them do it. They also can do it in nonfiction as well. So that can also help to develop some really important skills as far as, you know, are you understanding the who, the where, the what, the when, and the why of this article? And I can, again, set up those questions along the way. In reference to the tool, it can be used in every curricular area. So there's social studies, science, and, you know, all the different humanities things that are out there. And you can pull up articles that are already existing. You can reach out to them and ask them to pull up articles. You can also upload articles. The other thing too is that you can insert videos, which is really cool. I worked with a group of kids a few years ago. I said, all right, listen, I'm going through the short story and kids aren't getting it. Stay after school with me and help me figure out what it is that they're not getting. Show me where the flags were. And essentially what they came up with is they're like, well, if we knew this in the beginning, then it would have been okay as I read the story. So then I embedded a video just in the beginning of like, here are some things to think about while you're going, which was much better than making them read it and then read it again. And then the student experience was so much better because it was almost like they got my lecture beforehand. So that's really cool too, because you can embed videos and you can do like the Ed puzzle type videos where you insert the questions and check for understanding. Again, all of it is so literacy based. It literally handles reading and writing. It also can track standards. So if there's a specific standard that you are trying to work on with your students, or more importantly, if you don't know what standards to work on with your students, you can create these stories and put these standards in and see how your students are answering these questions. And you can grade them, like they can be like multiple choice or they can be short answer. And what it will do is it will data track the standards as well. So if you have a student, it'll actually track fluency too. So it'll tell you how long the student took to read it, which is clutch. So I can start to gauge which students need more time on their assignments. The other part is it'll track the standards, so I can see who's having problems with comprehension, you know, just understanding the basic facts of the stories, who's having problems with analysis and analyzing the stories. So I can track my standards and then develop my lessons based on that data. But I can also provide individualized instruction, because now I can create very specific, so I could take the story and only assign it to a few kids and have them just work on one specific standard and take the story and then assign it to another couple of kids and have them work just on fluency or work just on, you know, not comprehension, on analysis. So it's multifaceted. It really is kind of the answer to all of my literacy prayers. I use it, and that's really what it is. So the way that I use it is I use it in my virtual setting to take the place of three-dimensional books. I use it in my virtual setting to take the place of annotating, having them annotate and leave notes. It's hard to have a kid annotate in virtual, but yet it's still a really important skill set to teach kids, to ask them, you know, to develop that neurology where they're doing the who, what, where, when, and why while they're reading, and to kind of have a system in place, whether it is taking notes or, you know, identifying a specific literary device or however the teacher chooses to have them annotate. But that is a way that I use in virtual, because I can't be in the room with them and they're never going to be in the room with me. In the three-dimensional setting, that is where I love it the most, because I am doing the in real-time assessment of where they're at, getting them back on track, and then working them through it. Now, I'm going to also be doing a unit with them where I'm going to be assessing their writing as well. So I do some writing. I do a direct explicit instruction unit in writing where I go through and teach them exactly a specific framework of writing, and I load up a PDF of it and I insert the questions, so then I can see them writing thesis statements, and in real time I can assess them, send them back, but then I can also open it up so they can see all their classmates' responses, so they can see who figured it out and kind of model their writing, because modeling is so important when learning writing, you know, to see what people are doing right, to see what people are doing wrong. And that allows me to do it because I can do it as a PDF and the kids can go in and write it. I can comment, I can flag it, say, yes, that's good. Why don't you try it this way? Why don't you look at this example? Go see this classmate's work. So it's not just literature. It is also the literacy part of it. And again, I straddle those two worlds.
That is just like, this whole tool just sounds so incredibly powerful. And just like English teacher to English teacher, like bravo for how well you have thought through really building the process of literary thinking, of critical thinking during sort of the process of reading. This just sounds like such a powerful tool. And what really stood out to me about what you said, especially in your in-person setting, and I think this will probably be a powerful part of this tool in my own classroom as well, right? Because for the way that our virtual school works, it's not asynchronous. So we still have live classes, you know, at like 9 o'clock, or a live class at like 12:30 or 11, or, you know, during sort of the different blocks. So we are together all at the same time. We're just like in different places. And so I think this will help bridge the gap between that space, I think, very, very well. But I loved what you were talking about when you were saying it allows me to do things in real time. And it actually made me think a lot about video games. So it made me think about cycle time, which is this idea that when you're learning at the beginning of a video game, you are trying to fail very, very quickly. And a lot of games are designed, in fact, to make you fail at whatever your first task is very, very quickly so that you learn very, very quickly. One of the games that I played last year was Celeste. And it's a platformer game that's very, very challenging, very, very rigorous. And the way that the game teaches you to play it is that even though you're going to fail a lot, the time for your player to spawn back in on that platform is incredibly fast. So you may fail a whole bunch, but you're going to get to fail basically unlimited times without consequences. Just go back and try it again, go back and try it again, go back and try it again. And I think that what this does, this program, is it sounds like it's going to hopefully be the ability to do that. But for reading, right? You missed this thing. I can see that you missed this thing. I'm going to have you go back and just try it again. And I can see that process in real time, while at the same time, other students who maybe got it right away can go back and sort of be working on something later in the text or moving forward.
Yeah, that's it exactly. That's a great metaphor for it, because it's essentially they're shut. Like, is this right? Is this good? And I'm like, yay, go on. And they get the little dopamine, like, you did great, move on to the next thing. Or it's like, no. Like, you got to do, you know, go back, try it again. And sometimes I'm tough. Like, you're almost there. You almost got it. Do it again. And yeah, they absolutely. And they never quit. They just keep going. And it does sound like what you just described with the whole video game model.
Allison brings everything back to video games.
They're an analog for so many things, right? So many experiences are about progressing through something and learning something, right? Because ultimately, I think that's so much of what we do in life, right? Like, the whole sort of life is a game thing comes back to it a lot. And in school, you know, the thing that I always try to say to students is, you are here not necessarily to learn an individual subject. I'm sure that Emily hopes that you learn a lot of history in her class. I certainly hope that you learn to read. The most important thing that I hope you learn to do is learn how to learn, right? Because ultimately in your life, you are going to have to go out into this world and you're going to have something new, whether it's how to fill out a job application or some really crazy basket weaving class you take in college. You're going to have to learn something new. And right now you have teachers who are here to help guide you through this experience and scaffold things for you. And so the pedagogy that we give to them, I think, is really, really sort of the most valuable thing that we give students. And I like what you're talking about in terms of saying, I want to create a space for my students where we're doing the thing. And I am helping you walk through that process, but you're going to read. You know, we're not going to choral read this situation where, you know, we're popcorning back and forth. You are going to read, and I am going to be your Yoda. I'll be your guide through this experience to sort of push you in that direction. So I think that's so wonderful.
Yeah. The real time factor of it, I think, is where the best learning occurs, is when I'm right there. And it's hard sometimes because you have a bunch of kids that are popping up answers on the screen and you're just, you know, typing away. Thank goodness my mom told me to take that typing class back in the 90s. To knock it out real fast, but to give them that real live feedback, and they just keep going back, and they keep going back, and then they get, and then they, it'll be hysterical because the room will be silent, and you'll just see a kid put his hands up in the air like, I did it, I got it. She said I can move on, and it's like this sweet sense of relief, like they just won the video level.
Well, I was just gonna say, kind of along with that, because something you mentioned about how it like chunks it for them, and they can't move on to the next question until they've answered it. I have some students who, probably everybody has these kids, who like to rush through it and just be like, well, I answered everything, so now I'm done. And even though things are chunked, because I'll use like Edpuzzles and things like that, So even though it's chunked, they'll get like every answer wrong, and I'll be like, but you clearly weren't paying attention. Or in the case of a reading or something, they'll rush through and not read closely to get those correct answers. So do you have any, how have you kind of solved that problem, for lack of a better term?
Well, I think, I really think that reading in general is probably the most difficult thing that we ask students to do. And if it's, for many kids, it's not an easy task. A lot of kids, we do have a literacy problem in the country where we're not teaching kids appropriately how to read. I mean, the latest data this last year is astounding. And many kids have a lot of, trauma associated with reading, a lot of negativity, negative feelings. So the non-preferred activity, it's a very much non-preferred activity. So there is a lot of students, when left to their own devices, will choose not to do it. And I understand that. I mean, I do not like to run. I'm not good at it. It doesn't feel well, and I look funny when I do it. So when I go run, whoever's running with me, whoever's leading that charge, has to be really kind and gentle with me and give me a lot of positive feedback, and not assume that I'm not running because I can't run, but that it's hard, a place of empathy. And I think what active Learn does is it does provide an opportunity to encourage them too, because there's some times where I'm just like, you are crushing it, or you're almost there, I'm so proud of you, please don't give up on this. Like, you can literally put in those types of coaching mechanisms in there for them and tell them like, hey, this was a tough one, you nailed it. And again, there's feedback that I can provide for the kids that are flying through it, and there's feedback that I can provide for the kids that are struggling. Kids love praise. I don't care what grade they are, and I don't care what level they read on. They love to be praised. Who doesn't like that? And Actively Learn will give you the opportunity to not only just like say you got this wrong, but also to kind of coach them in. And that's what I do in real time. I mean, you guys have met me. I just love to like tell people, you're doing great, you're awesome, let's move forward, And the tool will allow you to do it, especially in a virtual setting, because it can also be done where it's you're not embarrassing them. Sometimes we have the kids that are really, really good at stuff, and they don't get compliments either. The kid that gets everything right, it's not like you're sending a note saying like, you're so awesome. So you can, privately send them a note like, I'm really proud of you. Like, you really kicked butt. You're right on top of this. I'm really impressed with how awesome your analysis skills is. You're good at this, right? And then you have kids that you can say to them, this was really hard for you, and I think we need to pause and acknowledge that there were so many times you could have quit on this, but you didn't. And the program will allow you to kind of have those private text message moments that the student, you can share with the student. The other thing that's great is it can give you a lifeline. Like, the student can message you directly and say like, I really am just not getting this, or, this is, why is this so much harder for me than everybody else? And you can have those kind of back channel conversations, and it can be received versus like in the entire classroom where everybody hears it, or over the microphone where everybody hears it, so it does create an intimacy where you are, it's a one-on-one, environment is what it feels like when you're in the program. Now, it's me and 30 kids, but for the student, it feels like it's just me and them in the program. And that, I think, can help out with the non-preferred activities, Emily, that you were talking about, the kids that don't want to pay attention and just want this to be over with. If it feels like you're having a direct conversation with them, it may be more appealing and engaging for them.
I think that this sounds like a really, really powerful tool. And I also think that this is a kind of perfect segue to my next question, which is that when we are introducing something new to students, and I'm going to let everybody on this lovely podcast right now in on one of my biggest insecurities as a teacher, which is that I very rarely change a program mid-year on my students. I am like terrified of doing it. So I am so excited to use this program, but I am also very nervous about implementing something new, because one of the things about my classroom is that it is a co-taught classroom. And so I work with a special education teacher, and the two of us do a lot of collaborating and working together to create, an environment that is very, very accessible for a very wide range of different learning levels, of different sort of neurotypicalities, all sorts of stuff. And I know sort of you as a mother, you know a lot about sort of the struggles of students coming in to a classroom and really trying to make reading and writing accessible. and something changes, right? And that being a very difficult experience for some of our students, especially some of our students maybe on the spectrum, you know, we take a lot of time at the beginning of the year to really train them in this is how we do things. This is kind of the shell. And then the rest of the year, you know, we can kind of do different things inside of this shell. So this is going to be a moment where I'm going to be pushing myself to do something new. So I wanted to hear a little bit about maybe some of your best practices in terms of how do you introduce this program, this way of thinking to students in your class? Or how would you want someone to introduce it to your child? How much time would you sort of want to give for them to sort of play around? Do you give them demo texts? What is sort of the best practices that you use for implementing this in the classroom and getting students ready to do something different? Because sometimes I really think that in classrooms, it's not just about what we're teaching, but how we're teaching that is the difference between a student feeling really great about themselves and a student feeling really sort of othered or pushed away in the classroom.
Yeah. So, you know, great apprehension. Great question, because I can understand your apprehension around, you know, I'm going to use this tool in real time while I'm learning it, and that can be really overwhelming, especially when you're working with special needs students and the stakes are just so high for them. I think that with, I do teach this in the inclusion setting. So I have students who have a specific learning disability, who may have emotional disturbance as well, or some OHI. And essentially, there can be some, you know, concerns sometimes when you change things. And I totally appreciate that. One of the things that I like to do when I teach my kids is I like to hyper-focus on things. And I joke around with them all the time, like, we're going to do this and we're going to do it until we need to do it. And then we're going to walk away with it. So I like to hyper-focus on units. So when we are doing our actively learn like unit where we're going all in on stuff, I will start in the incremental phase. So the first thing they'll get is a poem, where they'll do the actively learn in the poem. And we talk about it. What did you like about it? What did you hate about it? And they're like, oh, that was so cool. I can't believe that you were able to do that. And I got a question from you. You know, I got a question from you and I was able to answer it. And we kind of just like experience it just like on a poem level. And it's like 4 questions.
Okay. Yep.
And then we break out into, we have like an American Dream unit. So then I'll do like a nonfiction piece with them where they will work on it. Then with them in real time, you know, and they're just kind of, but it's like nonfiction. It's like not as high stakes. I feel like my students get a little bit more anxious about the literature when they have to try to do the analysis part, you know, the English teacher stuff. Right. So then we go to, a short story. And then, so we do like the poem, then we do the nonfiction, then we do the short story. And then by last marking period, I go all in with a full novel with them. My first novel that I do with them, I do it three-dimensionally, but then I have them do all of their responses digitally by the end of the marking period, because they're tactile still. So I kind of have to like transition them, you know? And then I have them do we do Great Gatsby completely online, using Actively Learn. And, so it is a process. I kind of build up to it. For me, because it's brick and mortar, I can also do it as sub plans, which are awesome. So if I'm out, I can have them do it, which they get excited about, because they don't like it when the subs actually try to teach. They kind of get like, this is weird. So this, I can still teach them while they're doing it. So I can have all my, you know, little questions embedded, but I can also have my thoughts. Now I'm not assessing it in real time. However, I do have a funny story. The one time I was on my way to work and I blew out a tire. So I was on the side of the road and I put in I called to the sub person. I was like, yeah, listen, I need someone to cover my class, have the kids get the Chromebooks, to get them on the Actively Learn and have them do this assignment. So then they get on, they think it's just a sub situation. And then I start messaging them in real time from the side of the road. And they're like, this is weird. This is so weird, Woodard. You're such a nerd. And I was like, what am I doing? I'm waiting for a tow truck. I might as well assess what's going on, you know? So that was kind of a neat experience to be able to do that. They were like, you're nuts. But, so I do think that sometimes easing into it is good if you are concerned about the response. Now, one thing I can say is that it is very special ed friendly. it does do the speech to text. I'm sorry, the text to speech. I keep getting that backwards, where it will read it. It also has a dyslexia font, even though I don't like calling it a dyslexia font because the way a dyslexic sees has nothing to do with being dyslexic. However, they do. It's titled the dyslexia font. But essentially what it does is it spaces it out so that the kids who are overwhelmed by so many words on the screen, who may have a processing issue, it seems like less words. It gives them bigger spaces. So that's nice. They can also change the settings. So for some reason, I find this very odd, but you know, I'm not a Generation Z kid. They like to change it to a black screen with white print. That seems so bizarre to me. So they'll change they can change the format. They can make it a purple screen, whatever they want it to be. They can change the size of the font. And that is helpful to give them a little bit of choice. Sometimes can help lower that anxiety. If they're like, all right, I'm going to put it in this font, or you're really going to let me listen to this. I really don't have to read this. You're really going to let me listen to this. Yeah. If that's how you want to, it's not about eyes on paper. It's about, do you understand what this author is trying to communicate to you? That's what literacy is. So I think for special needs students, there are some tools that it can be put into place. If given the opportunity, if you can get past that initial apprehension of, oh my goodness, this is something new. The other thing too is it's how you assess it as well. So I don't do really much punitive grading. So I'm a big believer in second chance, third chance, whatever it takes learning. So the students feel really safe kind of in my class that if I read the story and I get these questions wrong, not only is she guiding me along, but say I put like a little multiple choice quiz at the bottom, they don't get hurt for not understanding the story. That's a deficit that they have. If they read it and they don't understand it, that's a deficit. There's nothing that should be punished. They shouldn't be punished for that, you know? And so they get an opportunity to go back in and we, you know, conference. What do you think you could have done differently? You know, what do you think? Why do you think you missed that? What was happening? You know, and we can have some aha moments in that process of second and third chance learning. So that can kind of take some of the pressure off.
Well, and that's metacognition, right? Like that's the, you know, the teaching of getting them to think about their own learning.
Yeah, I had a cute little experience with a young lady a couple of weeks ago where she kept on getting this quiz wrong. And at first I was like, all right, something's happening with the notes. So she went back in and she's taking better notes, doing better annotations, blah, 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 whatever. She takes it again and then she's off. So then I'm like, let me take a look at the exact question she's getting wrong. So I look at it and I'm like, all right, so what are you thinking when you're answering this question? What are you thinking? And she's like, well, obviously it was something, it had to do with a separate piece. And she was like, well, obviously, you know, Finney's mad at him. Like he intentionally tried to hurt him. And I'm like, what's obvious about that? She's like, well, who wouldn't be mad at him? And I'm like, honey, I'm like, you're missing. I'm like, here's the thing. I'm like, you're inferring. You're putting your own information into that. Like, you have to really pause and read the words and listen to the words that the character's saying and not place your own feelings on it. So then she's like, all right. She's like, so I just have to have an open mind. I'm like, have an open mind. So she went back in and she was like, wait a second. He like really isn't mad at him at like all? And I'm like, no, not at all. I'm like, that's the whole point of the story is this guy's like so ridiculously, so ridiculously forgiving, you know, and this guy feels so much guilt because of it. And she was like, oh, and then that really kind of helped her realize like, all right, this is not my experience. This is the author's experience. And I can't, you know, put my own stuff on it. The other thing that I really like about it too is so often when we're assessing literacy, and this really frustrates me. And I did this for years. Anytime I meet a student that I had a couple years ago, I always say, listen, I'm really sorry. You had me at a time when I was a bad teacher. So I want to apologize in advance. But one of the things that I think we do as literacy teachers is we really don't acknowledge just how hard it is. And we assume when a kid is getting something wrong that they just didn't do it. So for example, we assume that they, you know, if I have the students read and they're sitting at the desk and then a kid takes a reading comprehension, I just assume that they went through it too fast, or they didn't actually do it, or they lied and said they did it. And that's like dangerous, right? Because if a student has an issue, a specific, you know, literacy issue, for me to assume that it's their behavior or their motivation that's interfering with the learning versus actually knowing whether or not it's the reading, that can be dangerous. So I like the actively learn because I can see them doing it and I can see the mistakes they're making in real time. So it takes away that, well, you just didn't read this at home or you just didn't do your part, which I unfortunately was a knee-jerk reaction to that. A lot of times it was like, well, it's not the literature. It's got to be you. And I've learned through this process that like kids do things like this young lady did where she brought her own baggage to it or her own, you know, emotional, how she would respond to it. Or I have some kids that like, I'm just shocked that like, you just really aren't getting this and really have to, you know, support them. And in the past, I would have just thought the kid didn't do the work or wasn't as motivated. But now I'm seeing them like if it's taken 6 and 7 times to go back through the same chapter, that's a big deal. So then I can modify my instruction then to really support that child where she needs me while she's with me. Where in the past I didn't do it. It wasn't that individualized of an experience where this really gives me some individualized data. So if you're a data person, but also that individualized experience of how hard these kids are working and yet still not getting it.
That is really beautiful to me. I think in part because once again, in our cyber world, we have a very similar struggle, which is that if you don't physically see a student every day, if you're not really careful, it can be easy to project what is going on the other side of that screen. And I think that in our conversations about differentiation, I think there's a lot of push to talk about data. And data is certainly really important, but more so than data, what you're talking about is empathy. And I think that empathy is probably one of the most important components to really individualizing, to really giving that child what they need. And in order to have that empathy, you know, maybe what we need isn't necessarily, you know, a spreadsheet of numbers, you know, that says, you know, this is what a student has and this is what a student does it. It's watching a student or it's looking at a student doing something very difficult for them and gathering data in some other ways, right? I think that we have a tendency to really spreadsheetify so much of what that looks like or what differentiation looks like. And so I find what you're talking about very, very beautiful because it is really about empathy and it is really about coaching a child through a difficult experience in learning.
Yeah. And the program allows you to have it be different. Yeah. It will be whatever that kid needs.
Yeah.
You know, for that story. Yeah.
That's great. Let me tell you, my fears are so assuaged. It sounds like it's going to be so
I mean,
wonderful.
I hope so. I mean, I hope I'm not overselling it. I know I really love it. I scream from the rooftops every presentation. And, you know, my district, unfortunately, has not purchased the big program where everything's free and you have access to all this stuff. So I actually put out a ton of money on my own because I believe in the product so much. Like, I mean, I pay for it to be available. And then the way that because I have the personal program, I then have to buy the books. I have to rent the books for the kids to have access to. So then, you know, for every book, I have to multiply that by how many kids I have and then pay for that. But there is a program where you can get, the district can get it and all the books is, you know, are accessible that it's paid for. And that's awesome because then you want to talk about personalized instruction. So if every single, you know, class, like we're a classist school, like all the books have to be classics. So if all the classics are available to these kids and I can track them and monitor them, well, why couldn't they just choose whatever book they wanted? You know what I mean?
Ooh, right? Isn't that the dream though? Like the dream is just like a completely open, like skills-based reading experience. Like,
I mean, and with this tool, you could do it. I mean, I'm not there yet because again, I don't have that much money to buy everybody the book they want. But if my district ever went all in, absolutely. And you could collaborate with a couple of different teachers. So if you were, you know, two different teachers teaching and you're like, all right, you handle Great Gatsby, you handle a separate piece. And then you can take kids from other classes and, you know, respond and assess them. And it doesn't have to necessarily, it's that whole PLC model where, you know, we teach everybody. And that could happen as well. I mean, there's just a lot. I think as I get deeper and deeper into the ed tech and it becomes more of just like, you know, a normal tool, not a novelty, where it's really like one of my go-to tools, I'm finding that what it's doing is it's really changed the pedagogy and my approach to student learning in such phenomenal ways that I never could have foreseen. You know, and, you know, that's pretty cool to know that a tool could do that. It takes you a little while to master it, though. You know, you got to kind of, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen this semester, ladies, but it definitely has that potential.
So it's funny, though, as I'm sitting here listening and like, I was totally that kid who in English class when we were reading, I think it was Macbeth, who, when they were like, well, her white dress means that she's pure or something. And I'm like, well, how do you know that? Like, why? There's like symbolism. Allison has heard me rail about this before. Like, symbolism 100% lost on me. Like, what if she just wants to wear a white dress? Like, why does it have to mean something?
That's so funny.
Totally me. But so obviously, because we're trying this out and we're not 100% committing yet.
Sure. Oh, yeah, 100%. Absolutely. That's how I got into it, was the free version first.
Yeah. So are there, I'm going to use the word disadvantages for the free version, like things that you don't get with the, obviously you don't get access to every test.
Yeah. So yeah, you don't get access to every test. I think your data points, you don't get as much data, I think. But in reference to the things that I was telling you about, you might not have as many right-click options. So right-click options are like the things that the kids can do. It was a couple of years ago. I mean, I've been using it about 4 years now. So my first couple months was when I was using it, the free version. So I don't really remember exactly what the difference is. I do know that it was still like, I was like, this is a magical tool. And the main reason why I wanted to purchase it was because I wanted more access to some of the data points. That was what I kind of wanted to have access to. Mm. Oh, and I wanted to upload my PDFs. Yeah. So you can't upload PDFs, I believe, in the free version. Now it's coming back to me. So I wanted to start uploading my own worksheets, I guess is what they were. And that was before I actually had a real LMS that I was using in my regular classroom. So I don't necessarily have to use it now in Actively Learn for like the LMS. Like, I'm sure if you have a worksheet, you are on your digital platform, you can give them that, you know, obviously. But I remember thinking that was a really cool function that would like seem so cool and so new. So that was one of the reasons I was drawn to it. But there, like Macbeth is free. You mentioned Macbeth. Macbeth is a free one. That one comes with the program. And it's kind of like, you just kind of have to go into it and see. Emily, you're social studies, right? Is that right?
Yeah. Then that actually, I mean, we can roll into that question too. So like for content area teachers, obviously I sometimes say I know enough mm-hmm. to be dangerous about ELA, like incorporating. And honestly, I spend hours trying to find text just because it's hard to find text for ancient history. It really is. So I'm hoping that there are some that are on there, but I know you're an English teacher and not a content area teacher, but how do you think the best way would be for me to do it? Like in class, for homework, small group?
I think one of the, like, in-class activity, you know, give them, you know, a document that you would want them to look at. So like, if you go under the social studies, I'm clicking on it right now. They have a subcategory, ancient world and early empires. Then they have modern world history. Then they have U.S. history, and they kind of have it broken up by decades or something. Maybe. Oh, these are centuries. Listen to the English teacher trying to talk history. But then you kind of go in. So what do you teach? Like what specific, like what's a unit you would? Oh, Roman Republic.
That would work.
Roman Republic and Roman Empire. So if I click on that, so like now I'm looking at it and it's like, there's a thing about gladiators and chariots, Pax Romana. I don't know what that is. I guess that's a story, 4 pages long, 5th to 9th grade reading level, the Roman Republic. It's an article about what policies in Rome helped it grow from a tiny village to a grand empire. So there's textbook sections. Okay, so that's what it is. It's broken up textbook sections. So life of the people in the Roman Empire, the fall of the Roman Empire, trade in the Roman world, Julius Caesar. So then there's articles. So ancient Roman sewers are amazing, smelly, stinky, and still in use today. So then you can, you know, tie it back to this Roman emperor's motivational advice will definitely get you out of your bed in the morning. So these are actually articles. And then there's some videos, it looks like, and then related assignments. So the ruin of the empire, that's 516 pages. So there's a book here. Yeah. These are all things that I'm not seeing that I have to pay for. That should be accessible to you. So that's okay. Just in the Roman Empire. So you can put together like a little unit. You could do it you know, as the primary thing. You could do it as a homework thing. You could do it as like a supplemental thing. So if the kids were working on something and you're like, all right, pick two things from here. And, you know, you have to get, you know, two of these activities done. You can go in and pick which one makes the sense, you know, makes most sense to you, you know, read it, you know, get it done, that sort of thing. So there's a couple of different ways, I think, Emily, that you can do it. And there's grade levels. There's also Lexile levels. So if you're worried about a specific reading level that they're on, and then you can also look for stuff based on the standards. So, and I think it's based on the Common Core standards, my understanding. So, yeah, so there's a couple of different ways to search for things. But, you know, I've never taught history, but I could see how I could put some units together to supplement what I'm already doing.
Yeah. I also like the idea that you had said at the very beginning about being able mm-hmm. to put like videos in and using it instead of Edpuzzle. Cause I use Edpuzzle too, but I'm like, oh, right. This is another site. But if I can just take what I would normally put in Edpuzzle mm-hmm. and put in here, then they just all of Roman Empire, we go and do an actively learn or something.
Like you get a grade book. So then it would be tracking your work essentially in one place. That kind of anytime you can get it into one place, that's a good thing. I don't use this function, but there's an independent reading catalog where they can actually, you can say, all right, I need you to pick two independent readings, you know, and they can actually go in and the articles will come with questions already embedded. So then they can go, so you can go in and embed questions and direct it any way you want, or you can use the questions that are already there. And they're good quality questions. I mean, I've not been disappointed. Sometimes I laugh at some of the, like, sometimes they'll highlight something. Like in The Great Gatsby, it's like they always want to show a picture of the green light. Like, I'm like, do kids really not know what a green light looks like? You know what I mean? Like, and isn't the whole point for them to establish what they think the green light is like, you know? So that sometimes I kind of get like a little bit like, why would they put that there? But then you can delete it if you're uncomfortable with it, but there is an independent reading catalog. So if you want them to work on their own reading stuff, then they can, and they can track it. You can go in and see what they read.
Well, and what a great resource for PLT too. So we, for people listening, we do sort of a target time. Many, many schools do a version of this now where you're working with select groups of students on things that they're struggling with or extension sort of going beyond. This is really great because you could do some student choice with that and say, you know, I want you to be reading during this time. You know, this is going to be 20 minutes of reading, but you can make a selection. You just have to tell me what it is. And I can watch you doing it because I know one of the big things with, you know, that kind or that style of personal learning time has been, you know, how do you know what the students are doing?
Yeah. The other thing is too, on the data, you can see how much time they spent reading it too. So, you know, technically they could just, you know, go in and answer a question, go to the next thing if you're not supervising it, but then you'll see they only spent 2 minutes on it. And you're like, wait a second, you know, so it gives you feedback on the data table, how long they took it. And it'll also tell you, like, if a kid spent, like I had one young lady, she read No Exit, which the majority of the kids, it took them 35 minutes. And it took her 75 minutes. And I was like, yo, is this a legitimate, and she was from my virtual class. Like, is this really how much time you spent on it? And I was like, super worried about it. And she was like, She was like, oh yeah, I didn't spend that much time on it. She's like, but if you look, I wrote so many annotations because I was totally digging it. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, like, oh, that was cool. I'm glad. And then I looked at her annotations and it was like, this reminds me of when this person said, like, she was going, because it's all existentialism. It's like, where is, you know, what happens when we die? So she was like really into it, but I was like, red flag. She's spending a lot of time on this. But it can track their, you know, how much time they're spending on it too, which can kind of, you know, open that thing of like, well, did you do it? Or, you know, how can you tell? Did they do it? Or did they just quickly answer the questions? So A, you can watch them do it by, you know, checking in real time, having the screen up. But the other part is too, you can check their minutes too.
That's great. Well, and it also solves your extension problem, right? Because that was something I was literally going to ask, was how do you deal with if students are reading sort of at their own pace in your class. I'm sure that there are ways that you handle like checkpoints, you know, we're going to try to get to this point or something. But how do you deal with everybody reads at different speeds? And so you're going to have some students that finish up very, very quickly. Do you put them into sort of optional readings or give them sort of, you know, the library at large to enjoy if they finish up early?
Yeah, so this is now not necessarily talking about actively learning. This is just talking about my own personal pedagogy. So I'm a completely homework-free classroom. We don't do anything independent outside of the classroom. So I joke around with the kids and I tell them that I'm that much of a micromanager that I do not want them working when I cannot see them. And the reality is there's a number of reasons why that is. But for me, it was number one, they weren't doing it. And if they were doing it, they were doing it in an unethical way. And I think that I don't think that we should have a society where we are slowly rewarding and rewiring the brain to say that, yeah, you do. When you do something unethical, you score points for it. And I think that's why we have a society of people who are kind of like, wait, there's certain levels of cheating. Cheating's not that bad. Plagiarism's not that bad. And now it is. And the reason is that we've incrementally, you know, we've taught them year after year that if you cheat a little bit, you're gonna get success for that. So that was a big thing for me while I went away from homework. But the other part was they weren't really working on the skill. And not to any criticism that of them. I mean, people get like, oh, kids these days don't read. And that's, you're lying. Kids have never read. That's the reality. And the reason is because it's hard. And I try to go to the idea of an athletic trainer. You know, when you are working out and you're trying to lose weight, there are easy parts of the workout and there are hard parts of the workout. And if I was an athletic trainer and I only did the easy parts, the parts that I liked, the parts that were fun for me, with my students or with my clients, they'd never lose weight. And, you know, if a trainer would never say to you, listen, we're only going to, you know, stretch today, but you do all of the running at home. I want you to run 10 miles tomorrow. That person is not going to run 10 miles. They need an athletic trainer because that's they can't true. Run 10 miles on their own and they don't want to run 10 miles on their own. They're coming to you. They need you because they can't do it on their own. So why are you making them do the hardest part of their workout alone? As educators, we do that constantly. Like, I'm a literacy person. I'm an English teacher. And the hardest thing that my kids can do is read. And I'm like, you know what? Let's do that at home. Why don't you go do that on your own time? So when you can come in, you and I can have a nice conversation about the book, because that's what I enjoy. I just like talking about what the green light means. So we're just going to chat it out. And that was what I was doing as an educator, was I was doing the fun stuff in class and making them do the hard stuff at home. And they weren't doing it. And I wasn't teaching them anything. So I shifted my whole pedagogy. And now all the hard stuff, the stuff that I really care about, like reading independently and writing independently, they are doing in front of me with my eyes on them. So what ends up happening in reference to pacing, that becomes a huge issue. It also then opens up a can of worms in reference to equity as well, which I'll get to in a second. So once I took all, like, total responsibility for my students and made them read in class in front of me, I started to learn how different kids approach reading, and that there is a huge difference between my strong readers and my weaker readers. And a lot of it had to come down to fluency, how fast they could read and how long they could read. So fluency and endurance was a big thing with my students. And essentially, that really was kind of shocking to me. I just assumed, out of ignorance, that everybody could read at the same pace, and they were choosing not to. But once I took it into the classroom and saw, hey, there are some kids that are really good at this and some kids that are really bad at it. So essentially what I've done, and this is something that's terrifying as a person, that, because again, I'm doing something new. How is this going to be perceived? But this semester specifically, I said, all right, there aren't going to be any check-ins where everybody has to be at the same spot at a certain time. Yeah. Yeah. It's terrifying, right? As an English teacher.
Oh my gosh. Like, my heart is palpitating for right? you, but I'm like on the edge of my seat.
Right.
What has happened?
All right. You know, last year I was homework free with the caveat of everybody needs to get to chapter 3, but I was like, all right, what if you're really going to be homework free and you really want every class period to be authentic? And the other part of that was everybody needs to get to chapter 3. I was letting the kids off the hook who were good readers. Right. Mm-hmm. So now yeah. I don't say everybody needs to be at a certain chapter. We're going to do 10 chapters of reading or 13 chapters of reading. What I say is we're going to do 20 instructional periods of 55-minute blocks in which we work on our reading skills. So what that means then is that in those class periods, they are working on what they need to work on. So essentially, what I do is I set it where, okay, so you have to read chapter 1, you have to annotate, and I teach them a certain way that I want them to annotate because I still believe in annotating. Then You take a reading check. If you do, if you get mastery, 80% or higher, you can move on to the next chapter. You have to read it. You have to annotate. You have to do the reading check. 80% or higher, then you move on to a written analysis response, and then you can move on to the next chapter, right? So I'm doing the reading, the annotating, the reading check, and the analysis. Okay. So that's all loaded into my LMS into Canvas, right? So they don't need to be at the same place at the same time. I don't need everybody to be on chapter two so that everybody gets chapter two quiz at the same time. So they can take the chapter two quiz whenever they are there in their thing, in their place, right? So what I found was that it was taking kids 55 minutes to read 10 pages because they were out of shape. You know, their endurance wasn't strong. So that meant, I realized very quickly, that meant they're not going to get to the end of the book in those 20 class periods. But what they got was exactly what they needed. So what my job became was less about them getting to this end of the line, you know, race that nobody is really actually assessing. Nobody on my job cares if they finish reading page 216. What they care about is, did the student master the standard of independent reading, right? That's what I'm being paid to do, right? So what I found was that the students were never left off the hook and they were getting exactly what they needed. So the class period, the 55 minutes, I just had to make sure they were working. That was it. That was my job, really, was to make sure that for those 55 minutes, they were engaged, that they were doing it. So I really became more of a coach. I'm really more of a coach than I am of like a, okay, let's talk about what happened in chapter two. And here's how you should have analyzed chapter two. And what do you think? Because the reality is that I have kids in class that are not ready to analyze because they're not even strong enough readers that they were able to get through it. And the reality is, if I told them to read it for an hour that night, they still weren't going to be able to do it. And that creates an equity issue. So now I have a situation where a kid's good at reading. So now I'm only giving him 15 minutes of work versus a kid who's bad at reading now has the 55 minutes of work, my class period, and then an hour of homework too. So I have a kid that's bad at reading that's now working harder than anybody else in the class. And I'm not even providing any real instruction to the kid that's good at reading. So when I shifted it to the 55-minute periods, the kid that's got the fluency moves on. Now they're working on getting those comp checks, right? And what ended up happening, which I'm sure you're anticipating, is that I had kids at the end of the unit that were on chapter nine, and then I had kids that were done five class periods early. So what did I do with the kids that were done five class periods early? Well, then I created these very individualized assignments because it was only a handful of them that actually got done and had like that big block of things based on the discussions that they made. So for example, I had one student and he was like, in the discussion in our analysis, he was really caught up on this idea that Finney really didn't have a voice in it, and that we really don't know if Gene was actually interpreting Finney's response very well. Like, he really kept writing about that. So what I did with him, I said, all right, so here's the deal, man. You're done the book. You've done everything good. Now we're going to move on. You still owe me four more 55-minute class periods. You're not done here, kiddo. Like, good for you that you're good at this, but you still owe me these other 55 minutes. So then what I had them do was I created the assignment. So for that kid specifically, I was like, all right, we're going to reimagine a separate piece now where Finney's now the narrator. And so, all right, so what do you think, what should that look like? All right, well, I think maybe I'm going to pick like five chapters and maybe rewrite a passage and see if he was the narrator, how would it be different, right? So now he's going really deep into the analysis. And now we're at like level four DOK where he's now creating.
Oh, yeah. Right?
He's creating more. Because that's what he can do. But the kids who are still working on fluency and endurance, they don't need a depth of knowledge level four question because they're still just working on getting the DOK2 level down where they're just able to read and understand what's going on and being able to answer questions on it. So essentially, that was an interesting eye-opening experience. And we got to the end of the class period because some kids were done it and had created like three supplemental assignments that I literally made up in real time. And then some kids literally just finished right on the day. Other kids didn't get done the book. Then we went in and we did this whole analysis where they went in and they did the metacognition. What do you think were your strengths? What do you think? And it's like, kids are like, I am weak at fluency. I can't believe it. All this time, I didn't realize that I was this slow at reading. Well, that's a really important thing to know when you're going into college And you're like, oh, 100 pages? I can do 100 pages in a night. No, honey, you can't, because you couldn't get through 10 pages in 55 minutes, right? So now they know, like, oh, 100 pages, I'm going to have to split that up. So there is this metacognition that they're learning about their reading, but I'm also learning. So now when I move forward into my next unit, I can differentiate now really based on what the kids need, right? So now when I'm moving forward in my planning, I'm looking at doing like a fluency group that's working on endurance. I'm looking at doing a comp group that's really working on understanding what's happening and working on developing those tools. And then my analysis kids, who are really, we're going to dive deep into the gray matter of what's going on. And I'm going to have it happen for them in real time, so they don't have to wait till the end of the book, you know, because I'm confident now that they'll get done the book so that I can kind of do it. And it's going to be this three-pronged approach that I'm going to have with these kids. At least that's what I think I'm going to do.
Well, and you can, they can own that goal personally, oh, yeah, right? Like if you have a student that says, I've had this realization that one of my big issues is fluency, and you say to them, then let's together make that better. Let's work on it together during these 55 minutes that we have, and let's track this and let's see you getting better. That's a measurable goal that they can take ownership.
Correct.
Of.
And that's what I saw too. I saw that too, because kids would be like, oh my gosh, I'm getting so much faster at this. Like I did a chapter. And I was like, I did two chapters this class period, you know, like, and there was that realization and that if they worked out, you know, just going back to that sports metaphor, that they would get faster. And they felt pride about that. Like, oh my goodness. But then some of them then ran into the comprehension wall where they were like, oh, yeah, but I don't understand what you said. No. All right, well, let's go back in and embed some strategies. Let's try this again. And then one thing, what I did do was the last, just two little caveats. The last three class periods, the last three 55-minute blocks, I said, you have choice how you want to approach this. I said, so if you want to abandon doing the annotations, then abandon doing the annotations. You got second chance learning. Right. So if you want to now not do the annotations because you are like, I think I got this. Like, I think I'm asking the right questions as I'm reading and I can pick this stuff up, then go for it. Like, that's great to know. Like, you don't have to, you know, I only write stuff down because I know I need to write stuff down, but that doesn't mean you need to write stuff down. Right. So now let's kind of experiment a little bit in those three class periods. The other thing that I did with the annotations was I gave them a challenge. So I had a couple kids that are like, dude, I can't do the annotations. You're crushing me. Like, I'm actually slower because of the annotations. So then I gave them a challenge. I gave them one challenge. I said, you pick one chapter in which you challenge me and say that you will read it without annotating. I said, but you've got to get an A on that reading comprehension. And if then when they got to the chapter that they thought they could challenge me on, they let me know, they read it, no annotations, took the quiz. And if they got a 90% or higher, then you know what? They were right. They don't need to annotate. They're doing just fine without it. So I allowed them to challenge that. So some kids did end up having a different path with their annotations. And then there were some kids that were like, yep, nope, not going to challenge it. Nope, I need my answers. You know, I need my notes. So I did at some point really kind of listen to them about, like, you know, what it was that was making them, and, you know, read slower, read faster, that sort of thing. So that was my first time this semester I did that. And that was terrifying. I was like, what is going to happen when they don't get there? And you know what happened? The bell rang, the class ended. They came in the next day and said, okay, what are we doing today? And I got no emails. Nobody cared. They didn't get to the end of, you know, chapter 13. And I was like, all right, cool. We're just going to move on to the next unit then. All right. We're going to work on writing now. And again, I like to hyper-focus. So that's why I was like, all right, we're just moving on. It's like, all right, so they don't finish. Oh, they don't finish. But they got 20, 55-minute blocks where we were working hardcore. And I got the data to prove it, you know?
Two questions, just because I'm curious. One is, did you have any kids who didn't finish, who like came back and told you they finished the book on their own just because they wanted to?
Well, it was actually really funny. I did have a couple kids, because it was the way that the marking period ended. We had a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Not marking period. The way that my unit ended was we had a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And then we were going to have two class periods that Monday and Tuesday was part of that three-day cycle. And there was a couple kids that were like, Woodard, can we take this home? And I was like, are you asking me for homework? And they're like, all right, you know that this sounds ridiculous, but seriously, like, I would really like to do it. Like, I really want to see what happens. And I know based on my pacing, I'm not going to get to chapter 13. would you be all right if I read this at home? And I said, here's the deal. I absolutely support you reading at home. I said, however, this is what I need you to be honest with. If you get to the point where you're like, I'm just going to spark notes this, I don't want you doing it. I want you to be ethical, and I want you to have an ethical experience with this book. So if you go home and you're reading it and you're still engaged and you're still motivated to get to that, I said, that's great. That's everything I ever wanted for you guys. But if there becomes a point, I said, but you can't do the quizzes at home because I like to assess it on Go Guardian. I said, but if there comes a point where you're just going to spark note it to get your annotations, or you're just going to spark note it and then tell me that you're done because you want to take the 13 quiz or whatever, don't do that. You know, keep it pure. You know, let this really be an assessment of what you did. So I did have a handful. It's a great question, Emily. I did have a handful of kids that wanted to do it at home and did it. And then I had kids that took it home and ended up not doing it at all. And they're like, yeah, I thought I was going to do it. Yeah, life caught me. You know?
I just know I would be the kid if I was slow. I'd be like, but I want to
know. Yeah, no, that did happen because they read it, you know? And that was the craziest thing about it too. Like, as English teachers, we think we have to explain stuff. We don't have to explain anything. They get it. They're not dumb. These books aren't that crazy difficult to understand that I have to explain to them, you know, 55 minutes about the metaphor. Like, I don't need to do that. Like, if they didn't read it, I needed to do that. And they're asking these engaging questions, really, just because they didn't read it. So they're trying to get a summary from me. But otherwise, they don't need it. They don't need the discussion. It just, we can do online discussions, you know what I mean, where we're going deeper. And I did that with some of my, with the kids who finished. We did the online gray matter discussions. And that's what I'm going to do different the next semester, is the kids who want to endeavor on the analysis part, and I'm going to give them choice on it, we'll be having discussions in real time happening on through the computer.
So do you, like, and this might just be us, like, we're all required to give the same test at the end of a unit. So do you not have anything like
that?
Yeah,
we have no common summative assessments. I don't even give tests at the end of the units. Like, I don't give, there's no final summative assessment. If I did, it would likely be some sort of project type thing. So we don't have anything like that. We're not required to have the same test. So I get off the hook a little bit that way.
I was just curious because we all have to do the same thing and it's set for us and we can't deviate and all of that.
Yeah, that's tough.
So. It is. At the same time, I know for ELA, and I know it's a little different, Emily, because you do content. Like, our common assessments at the end are all on texts that are completely new.
Oh, good. Yeah, yeah. Then you can do it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There's absolutely nothing keeping us from doing something like this. Yeah. And in some ways, what you're talking about is even a more authentic experience for what they're going to do on a common assessment, or even, you know, a dreaded PSSA assessment or something like that. Mm-hmm. Because you're going to come in, you're going to come to a new text, and do you have the skills to sort of tackle that experience, to make yourself sit down, calm yourself down in some capacity, right? And like, really look at the text, look at everything that I need to do, which is sometimes, you know, for you reading and annotating and then taking a quiz or maybe doing something that's written or something like that, and saying, I'm going to portion out my time and take it one task at a time. I mean, there's a lot of executive functioning that's involved in this process. And I think making space for the direct instruction of how do I sit down to do something, especially because you're talking about students who are about to go into college. And I can't tell you how many times in college I sat down with roommates or with friends or with, you know, someone who didn't necessarily have that skill, who was very bright in many, many ways. But the sort of skill of being able to sit down and get yourself to do something, maybe on a day when you didn't necessarily want to, or you didn't have that motivation, I think is really important. So in that way, I think what you're doing is just so incredibly brilliant. I do want to go to our question that we ask every single person who comes on for an interview.
Sure.
You are clearly doing this at like the highest of levels. And I am just like so inspired. I had to like mute my mic like 3 times because I'm like frantically sitting here, like taking notes of like, that's a really good idea. That's really interesting. Like, this is fabulous. But if you were going to go back and talk to, you know, a young teacher like my lovely self, or Emily, or sort of even a younger version of yourself when you were just sort of starting this journey, because I think what I love about what you're saying is it's not that this program gives you the ability to do a lot of things, but it's your philosophy about sort of reading instruction and your philosophy about teaching students how to do certain kinds of work that really is what, you know, is at the forefront of this discussion, right? Like, how do we make classrooms an active place of learning? And you're doing this clearly incredibly well. How do you, what advice would you give to someone who is sort of just starting out, right? Who is just like about to dip their toe into this world? What do you wish that you knew when you started? That you sort of now know well now and you wish that you could say to them?
I think the one thing that I would tell people is like, if they're just coming out now, is disregard everything you think, anything that happened to you in a class. Whatever methods Ooh. Your teachers were teaching you were based on an old, outdated pedagogy. And if they're just coming out of college now, they were dealing with non-21st century teachers who guaranteed were not using best practices. And so I would literally say, ignore literally everything you think what teaching is, because, you know, John Craig said it this year at KTI. I thought he said it best. He said, we have the best job because we had a 12-year internship, right? We were in classrooms for 12 years and just watching six different teachers a day or seven different teachers a day tell us, you know, what our job was going to be like, right? So we could sit there and say, oh, when I'm a teacher, I'm going to do this. When I'm a teacher, I'm not going to do this. And the reality is, it's like, it's a different world out there, man. Like, this model that we are trying and working so hard to sustain, it's not sustainable. It's really not. And I would recommend the teachers that are just getting into the field to really use their voice, take chances, and, you know, get involved with people that are fearless in the way that they teach, and do right, you know, hashtag do no harm. Number one, learn as much as you can about learning disabilities, learn as much as you can about trauma-informed practices, learn as much as you can about social emotional learning. The number one skill set that our kids are going to need in this, you know, computerized age is empathy. And you need to have empathy for what these kids are going through today, because it is a completely different world, and that their future is completely different than anything we would thought it would be. So get connected with teachers that are fearless, you know, that are just going to take chances. And I know that that comes with tenure, and I know that that comes with confidence and life experience. But really recognize that we have an awesome opportunity to change education. You know, my dad was a steel worker. And when I was a junior in high school, the steel mill closed down. And it was devastating. You know, everybody's dad was a steel worker, and all the steel mill closed down, and everybody's dad lost their job, and nobody had food, nobody had money. It was tough. It was a really tough time, but we were all in it together. But the point of my story was, I was in second grade the first time I heard a rumor that the steel mill was going to close down. It wasn't until I was a junior in 11th grade that it actually did, which means there was 9 years that went by that my dad knew the steel mill was going to likely close down. And there was an arrogance on his part that he would think that it wouldn't happen. He thought his union was going to save him. He thought people were going to respect and value his trade because it's what got them through World War II. He also had an arrogance that he was important, that somehow it mattered, you know, that he was a blue collar, hardworking guy. But the reality was that time changes, and he had an opportunity in those 9 years to be innovative, to see the tide and control the narrative. And instead of allowing the narrative to happen to him, and as a teacher, I feel like we all know that this system, and you know, you ladies are living it with a digital classroom, the brick and mortar, kids in the row, get to school at 7, stay until 3, take 6 classes, make sure you have your core classes. This model's not sustainable, and it's not working, and the data's showing it's not working. And unfortunately, we have classrooms after classrooms that these kids are sitting in learning stuff that they could have Googled. And we all know that the steel mill is closing. And as educators, be on the forefront, you know, control the narrative. I do not believe that we're not going to need classrooms, and I do not believe that we're not going to need teachers. But as an educator, I would challenge anyone who's getting into the field to be brave and try to control the narrative. Go out front and not say, here's what's wrong with education, but here's what I can get right with education. Here's what it could be. Here's what it should be. You know, change your why do I want to do this into how can I do it the best? How can I do it best for kids and make sure that our occupation and this beautiful thing that we have here where we have kids and our society will pay for us to work with these kids and get them ready and take advantage of it and make that time, you know, that 55-minute block that I want my kid to work so hard in, make sure that we as teachers are doing that in a way that's productive. So my advice to a new teacher is be fearless, connect with fearless educators, try to control the narrative, and do not do anything that your teachers did when you were in school. I mean, that's my advice. It might be terrible because you might not get tenure.
No, preach, sister, preach. Let me tell you. I don't think I can ask for anything more inspiring than that, Emily. You got anything like that? I'm feeling pretty inspired.
No, I love that analogy, though. Like, sorry that was a crappy life situation. That's a perfect analogy, though, like that you have that to draw on.
Right? Like, you know, my dad could have learned plastic. You know, plastic university, like, yeah, why didn't you try and get a job at the plastic company? You know what I mean? Or why didn't you try to be innovative with the way you use steel so that could be done in a different way? Like, really, you just sat there just waiting, you know? And that's what I feel like my so many teachers are doing, like, oh, kids these days, they're not learning anything. Well, number one, stop telling people that, because once they figure out they're not learning anything, they're not going to need you. Like, you know, like, let's keep that our secret till we figure this out and get it so that they can start learning.
Well, and this world, I think of sort of ed tech, you know, and I do think that there is sort of this huge spectrum, you know, you really see a blossoming, I think, in the world now between, you know, schools that are embracing sort of more of a hybrid model or even just one-to-one districts and sort of seeing, I think, getting computers in the classroom and one-to-one devices as being just as pivotal as it was, you know, 50 years ago to make sure that every kid had a textbook, you know, that this world really is very rich, that there are so many tools that allow us to connect as humans. And I do think that one of the things, and I'm sure Emily has had this conversation with, you know, people many times, when you say that you teach online or you teach in a cyber environment, I think most people imagine it to be a very sterile experience. Yeah. And in many ways, you know, that what technology does is allow you to connect with people, you know, across vast different distances, you know, very, very deeply. And so there is a lot that this world has to offer. You know, no matter what setting you're teaching in, I think there absolutely what you're talking about in terms of just sort of jumping in and trying something new and making yourself feel, you know, a little bit vulnerable, I think is such an important part of our practice. But I mean, I can't ask for a more inspiring way to end things off. So Holly, thank you so much for joining us. This was just an absolutely magical conversation. I am so excited to, you know, try all of this in the classroom. And we are so thankful that you were willing to be so giving with your time, but also with your advice and all this wonderfulness.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for giving me the chance. You know, not too many people want to hear me talk, so I appreciate it.
If you would like to hear more from Holly, and we certainly recommend that you do, you can keep in touch with her on Twitter at Holly, that's Holly. Wood24. We will see you back here on Tuesday, February 18th to discuss the upcoming conference PNC. It'll be a little break from our regularly scheduled program, but don't worry, we will be talking about what happens with our Actively Learn experiment on the other side of that podcast. In the meantime, you can keep in touch with us on our socials. We are on Twitter at Allison K Teaches and at Sattler Cyber. Please like, comment, and subscribe wherever you are viewing your podcasts. And we're looking forward to seeing you next time. Keep trying hard, everyone. See you then.